Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. In collaboration with the United Nations Food Systems Summit, we've launched the mini-series called Laying Down Tracks. Today, for the fourth episode of the series, we'll be discussing equitable livelihoods. Joining me as a co-host for this episode is the Director for Africa at the International Food Policy Research Institute, overseeing the IFPRI's Program for Gender Equality in Food Systems in African Region, Dr. Jemima Nuki. Hey, Jemima, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Aaron. So good to be doing this with you.
It is our pleasure. When I had a chance to read your background and bio, which I'll read for folks later on in a few minutes here, I was overwhelmed. You have done just amazing things. And I had a chance to see some of the videos you've done. Fantastic. So it is an honor. So thank you for taking the time. We're going to start by talking about the female lead. I promise we'll spend the majority of the time talking about equality, but let's talk about women crushing it and why that's just so important. There was an Australian study from a few years back which presented the idea that countries with more female politicians pass more ambitious climate policies. The study examined the legislatures of 91 countries and compared the percentage of seats held by women to the rigor of each country's climate policies. The study found that female representation in national parliaments does lead to countries to adopt more stringent climate change policies. In their analysis, they considered all kinds of factors, including the country's GDP per capita, education levels, and overall political orientation. I'll add that in addition to this, other studies have shown that more positive financial returns and employee satisfaction result when women are in the C-suite or they have a seat on a company's board. So, you know, what are we doing here? We got the stats, we're in a stat-driven world. It seems like a no-brainer here. Simply, we need more women leaders. But my question for you, Jemima, just to begin this, is to say, yeah, these female leads and the hope they represent, it's essential. Is it the elixir to drive gender equality for more, effectively getting girls to say, yeah, hey, she looks like me, I can do this, or more boys to expect to see female leaders as a norm?
I think it's both, Aaron. And as you say, it's really a no-brainer, because what having women in leadership brings is diversity. It brings diversity of opinions. It brings diversity of different styles of leadership. It brings diversity and representation into teams and into leadership. But more importantly, it also shows, as you say, other girls that they can also be leaders. It shows boys that women's leadership is the norm. But this hasn't always been the case if we look at history. And even up to now, we still have a lot of gender gaps in leadership. In political representation, we know very few countries have over 30% of women parliamentarians or women in top leadership positions in government. And a lot of this is because there's a lot of barriers that women in many and girls in many parts of the world experience. If you think about, you know, as a young girl growing up in rural Kenya, and I am from a family of eight children, and we were six girls and two boys. And really my earliest memories of being a girl was doing a lot of the household tasks in addition to the firm work that we did with the boys. So we would come from the firm and my brothers would be playing, but coming from the farm for me and my sisters meant that it was time to get the water, it was time to get firewood, it was time to cook. And that does present barriers to a lot of girls. There's still a lot of communities where the typical discussion about where to put education investment is, do we educate a girl who will then leave the home and go and get married in another home, or do we educate the boy who continues to stay in the home? So there's still a lot of barriers for girls around the world, but what we are also seeing is a lot of changes and a lot of progress. But we need to accelerate that progress. We need to get more women in leadership, not just because it's a right for them to have the same opportunities as men and boys have, but also because it just makes for a much better world for everybody.
It does, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, I'm obviously a dude here, but I'm a son, I'm a husband, I'm a dad of a daughter, and you know, I too grew up in a period of time where it was just like those are the social norms. Your point of boys did certain things, girls did certain things, and it seems at least maybe in 2021 here, those things are being called into question, or we're looking at it differently. Maybe they haven't changed completely, but we're at least having these conversations, which seemingly would have to be a positive step forward. Is that how you see it from your point of view?
That's how I see it. And it's especially problematic when some of those norms and stereotypes present barriers for women and girls. Because there's a certain point where there's division of roles and responsibilities. You say, you know, boys can cook, girls can cook, and it's okay. Boys can play certain games, girls can play certain games, and it's okay. But when those stereotypes, those norms then present barriers for either boys or girls, then that's where the problem comes in. When, because of unpaid care work, girls can't spend enough time in school, then it becomes a challenge. When, because of communities where pastoralism is rife and boys can no longer attend school because they have to look after livestock, then that presents a barrier for them. So there's a lot of action that we need to take in order to get rid of some of those norms, and especially those that present barriers for women and girls. When I look at even within our food systems as scientists, and we have brilliant women scientists, but we are still seeing such a disparity, especially in countries in the global south, and I think even in the global north, it's the same. In Africa, out of every 5 scientists, only one is a woman. And if we do not get women's talents, women's voices, women's skills into the game, we really can't get to meet our SDGs in 2030. So gender equality, which is part of the work I'm doing, is so critical to achieving our SDGs by 2030. It has to be central to everything that we do.
Hmm. Yeah, good stuff. So let me read this. I'm going to read a bit of your bio. I got one last question regarding some of the work you're doing in agriculture specifically, and then we'll jump into today's conversation with our acclaimed guest here. So in 2020, Dr. Nuki was named by the UN Food System a special envoy as the custodian for gender equality and women's empowerment for the UN Food System Summit 2021. She has worked for over 20 years in gender equality and women's empowerment in Africa and Asia. Prior to joining the International Food Policy Research Institute, she led the Growth and Economic Opportunities Program at Canada's International Development Research Center, the Women in Agriculture Program at CARE USA, and Poverty, Gender, and Impact Program at the International Livestock Research Institute. Dr. Nuki is an Aspen New Voice Fellow and serves on various influential boards. Dr. Nuki holds a PhD in development studies with a specialization of gender and agricultural systems. So I had in the preface talked a little bit about finance and kind of women's role and impacting finance. And speaking of some influence of power in finance, I saw some interesting video, a series that you put out, where you discuss why financial inclusion for women in agriculture is just so important. wonder if you could share with our audience some thoughts about that.
So one of the things that often happens with women when they want to become entrepreneurs, because of a lot of barriers in access to finance, and a lot of that is first how the financial system is structured, but also in terms of women's own identity the kinds of documents and assets that they have in order to be able to access finance. So a lot of them actually start their businesses from family money, either from their own savings, from their friends, from their families, from their informal lending and loans association, because a lot of financial institutions actually require that they have collateral, that they have land that they can put in as collateral if they want to get, you know, huge amounts of money. Financial literacy can be a huge challenge for women. Even how women are viewed when they go into a bank. Just until a few years ago, as a woman, you couldn't just even sign a loan without being asked for your husband's permission. Some of those things still happen in certain countries. And so part of the work that I was doing is most of the programs that want to improve women's access to finance have been focusing on the women themselves. Let's train women. Let's organize women. And my point in that work was, what if we actually reformed financial institutions so that they actually work for women? Yeah. What if we made some of these stringent measures that are locking out women from accessing finance? What if we fixed those? And what that would mean for women. But I was also recognizing that financial inclusion in itself is not important, because women work within an ecosystem. They work within families, they work within communities. So there's also a need to change the way those communities, those institutions within households, how women are perceived in terms of their ability to run businesses. In Africa, a lot of small businesses, informal businesses, are run by women. But access to finance has become such a major hindrance that we are not seeing a lot of them evolve into bigger businesses. And financial institutions just have to design and to deliver and to impact women with their products. If that becomes, and women are, they're 50% of most of our population. So if you think of them as half of your clients, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be designing products that work for them, why you shouldn't be having processes that work for them. And we are seeing a lot of that start to happen with very innovative financing mechanisms. And when you actually even think about women who are in the food systems, and I'll just give you a typical example. A woman wants to start a poultry business or a dairy business, right? They will go to the bank. But if you get a loan from the bank to do that, the month after that loan is approved, there'll be a requirement to make a monthly payment. But your cow is still a calf. Your day-old chicks are still day-old chicks. They haven't started laying eggs. And so these are some of the things we're calling on institutions to say, especially when you lend to women who are working in food systems, it's not the typical get a loan, end of the month, start paying, that we have to take into account. We have to understand what kinds of businesses are women in, what are some of their needs, what are some of their priorities, what are some of their constraints, so that we are designing for them. We need a world actually that works for women, so that they're not always having to experience barriers in a world that hasn't been designed for them and that hasn't been designed with them. And to connect to our earlier conversation, part of that also comes with having women in leadership in those financial institutions, because that starts creating an ecosystem that actually understands the constraints and the barriers and the opportunities that are present in terms of supporting women.
Yeah, I mean, institutions need to design and deliver for women. It's a no-brainer. So well said, Jemima. Thank you. That's great. It's a great conversation starter. So let's jump into that conversation today. So joining as our guest for Laying Down Tracks, episode 4, is the global lead for nutrition and public health at World Fish, Dr. Shankuntala Thilstead. Hey, Shankuntala, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you for taking the time. I know you're tired. Briefing the UN is a good reason to stay up late and to kind of to be tired the next day.
Yeah. And on the beast time zones, it's difficult, right? With me being in Penang.
Yeah, right. Well, lots of coffee, I think, right? We all pound that coffee in the morning. So, hey, so we'll be releasing this episode on June 8th, World Ocean Day. And investing in ocean health is proving to be an essential part of being on a shrinking planet here. So the lasting impacts of biodiversity loss and contamination in our oceans really have yet to be realized. And so much of that we hear is around doom and gloom, especially when it comes to the fisheries and aquatic food systems. But not from you. Everything that I have read completely geared towards empowerment, especially for women in aquatic food systems. Could you share with our audience some more about your work at World Fish?
Thank you, Aaron. First, it's good that we agree that we have a World Oceans Day. But I think we have to remind people what we are celebrating, the World's Oceans Day. And it's nice to have a short name that's catchy, but remember that, I think we all have to remember that it's not oceans alone, it's oceans and inland water bodies. And we were just talking about Jemima, and if you would work in parts of Africa, when you talk about water, you would be talking about the Great Lakes of Africa, and you'd be talking about wetlands in Africa. So I think we have to put that into consideration, that it's both marine and inland waters that we're talking about. And the other thing that bothers me a bit when we talk about oceans, or when we talk about waters, we talk a lot about the water itself and what's in the water and how we can use the water and the waterways for what purposes. And I think many times we forget the people who depend on the water. You take all coastal populations, you take the populations along the Great Lakes of Africa, the people who live in Zambia in the Barotse wetlands. It's very different to talk about waters when you talk about what's in the water and how you use the water, when you talk about the people who depend on waters for their livelihoods, for their income, for their food, and where the water is part of their identity and culture. So I hope that when we celebrate World Oceans Day, that we take a much more larger perspective, and a perspective that's people-centered.
No doubt. I think you're right. I mean, I think it is a catch-all. It's all about the waterways and the impact on the people, which I think you focus on at World Fish. Is that correct? I mean, the marine aqua system, marine food systems and how that impacts people. So is that something that you specifically focus on?
So if I would take my work, and I would give a little part of the work when I talk about working with food from waters, quite a lot of the work I do that I've done in many countries, I've concentrated on inland waters. So if you would look at the work I've done in Bangladesh, I've worked with homestead ponds, and I've worked with wetlands and wetlands water bodies. In Cambodia, I've worked with the populations that live along the Tonle Sap and the rice field fisheries ecosystems. And in Malawi, it's all inland. And I've also worked with inland ponds, inland waters. So quite a lot of what I've done has concentrated on populations, communities who depend on water, inland waters. And I've looked at the foods that come from this water and the diversity of foods from the water. And then I've zoned in on small fish species because of when you do the nutrient analyses of the fish species, you realize that the small indigenous fish species, as you have in Africa, the Dagar, the Usipi, the Kapenta, as you have in Bangladesh, Mola, Dela, as you have in Cambodia, Tripli Engleng, they are extremely rich in multiple micronutrients. Some are richer in essential fatty acids. And the way they are cooked, the way they are eaten, there's very little loss and waste. So you get the full benefits of these small fish. And they are superfoods. I mean, if you would take Africa and take the role that dried small fish and dried smoked fish play in the diets of Africans, that's the major, for many, the major animal source food, even for the poor and vulnerable. And even though they may be eating just a little, that's the major part. And what we would like to, much of the work that I have done is trying to increase the amounts that children, especially children and women, consume and the frequency of consumption. So if I can do that, if we could get more into the diets of young children from the age of 6 months, the recommended age for complementary feeding, and more in the diets of pregnant and lactating women, then we have a tremendous ability to affect growth and development in children, cognition in children, which has lifelong possibilities for school performance, work performance, and it's just intergenerational. And I would just hope that some of the economists who work with food systems find a way to value this national development that comes from a well-nourished mother and a well-nourished child, and just do not look at the monetary value of a kilo of rice or a kilo of maize. Or that would give us a much better picture of how one should look at national development and how we can progress societies.
Absolutely. Preventing those early years of children and the impact of preventing stunting and is incalculable at this point. I guess that's the point, right? Is we got to figure out a model that lets us put that into the systems. Shankotel, I may be wrong, but I don't see fisheries and the blue food economy being the most gender equal space. Now, tell me if I'm wrong, but maybe you could also share with us what innovations in aquatic food systems you're finding that will transform the livelihoods of women.
Well, first of all, Aaron, I struggle with this because I find that many of the solutions we have in agriculture, also in fisheries and aquaculture, takes time and takes women's time. And when you think about all the tasks and responsibilities that women have, I really hope that when we think about solutions and when we think about engaging women, that we, from the very beginning, think about how do we do this so that it's woman friendly, and there isn't this trade-off producing more, getting more food, but also working more hours. And I don't think we do I think we do too little in that. We are so focused on quantity, the quantities that are being produced. Very little focused on quality that's being produced, and very little focus on what are the best ways to make sure that what we do in terms of, for example, household pond polyculture fits into the way the daily work and life of the woman and her family. So with that production system that I've championed a lot, starting off in Bangladesh, but now moved to many other countries, pond polyculture. One of the things that I did was that established the ponds in the homesteads. That in itself can be a problem because in some areas of the world, say in Africa, in many places in Africa, you would have space on your homestead for having a pond. You go to to places in India where it's much more densely populated, and that can be a difficulty. So that's one thing. The production system that I've worked with helps, and then I can give an example. So you can have a production system as we have with the homestead pond. You can have large fish, which you can sell and have an income. You can have a mixture, diverse fish productions, small fish, which are extremely nutrient rich and which you can use part in your for your own meals. But how do you get the fish from the pond to the plate? And if you live in a culture where it's only men who capture fish, who net fish, and that's not a role that woman has, then you can have all the fish in the pond and the man goes off to work and there's no one there to catch the fish so that the woman can take it to the kitchen and to the pot. Yeah, so that was one of the things that I worked closely with our field staff, and what we did is that we set up a system with a net that could be pulled by pulleys, so the woman can stand at the banks of the pond, and this net that is permanent in the pond, she can pull it and get a small amount of small fish that she then can take to the kitchen to prepare the meal. So it's how we think about the role of women and the role of men, and how we understand the family structure and the different roles that each has, and how they help and assist each other, and how you get the whole family to function.
Those homestead ponds sound like a paradigm shift. I mean, a game changer. What a creative, insightful approach to that have layers of innovation opportunities. That sounds like... very impressive. And then obviously scalable, right? I mean, those things are going to be put on parcels and on lands around the world.
So my entry point was the pond and the production in the pond of both large and small fish. That in itself was a great difficulty to get through, because I mean, I'm not from the field of production, and I was working with aquaculturists who would tell me you can't grow large and small fish together. The one would eat the other, the production would go down, they would compete, right? Diversity is something that we've lost a lot in all our systems. So when there's someone coming and saying that let's try a more diverse system, there's a lot of pushback. So the entry point was a diverse production of fish species in the pond. And then I expanded that to vegetables on the banks of the pond, and if there was land in the homestead garden as well. And there were lots of pieces to that, you know, the training. How do you figure out about training? If you were trained in pond polyculture, where women are at home and they take care of the pond, then how would you impart that training? How do you impart that training to the man? And how do you impart that training to the woman? It's not the same methods that you can use. And then how do you, even though you have everything set up, then what about agency of the woman? What about her control of the income that comes out of the pond, that comes out from the vegetable? And how is that income used? So it's easy to say, let's get both men and women engaged in production systems within the food systems, but it's not that easy to implement. And you have to take into consideration the cultural norms and the practices that exist. And you may be able to break down some, which are harmful, but it takes a long time and it's not easy.
Yeah, I would imagine peeling back the layers of that onion. So Jemima, do you have any questions for Shakuntala?
What I would like to say, Shakuntala, is thank you for bringing out those issues, especially around unpaid care work and the burdens on women, because it's not all programs, projects, interventions that think about that. And I think it's very important. But also this issue of women's agency and control over income, because we have to look at this from different angles, that even when something technically works within a production system, if we want women to benefit, we have to think about their ability to make decisions on even how much of that fish will be eaten, how much will be taken to the market, what to do with the money from the sales of that fish. And a lot of this also requires engagement with men and boys. As you say, and as I said earlier, women do not live in isolation from the men in their lives and from the community. So it's a long-term process that requires really bringing together a lot of different expertise and different pieces. But Shakuntala, I wanted to ask you about this, the being the World Food Laureate, and what do you think that means for women scientists, but also for the work that you've been doing in making sure that small fish are an important component of production systems, they're an important component for women and children. What is your vision for this going forward? What can you say to inspire this next generation of young girls and young women who would like to go into this type of work?
Thank you, Jemima. And of course, winning the World Food Prize, I mean, then in the area where you work and the area where I work, we know about it. We know about this prize, and we know also of people who have won the prize. And I've never thought about, oh, that was a goal. But winning the prize, I was truly honored. And I thought it was deeply humbling to be in the ranks of the past laureates, some of whom I know. And I was also extremely happy that I was honored for the work that I did, because the work that I did is on fish and aquatic food systems in agricultural research. And that's not mainstream. So this recognition that my work has got, I think it's really a breakthrough, not just for me, but all the others who work in this area. And it's important to show that within agriculture and food, that aquatic foods and aquatic food systems can play an important role. And as you've heard me say before, the foods that come from waters, aquatic foods, are extremely micronutrient rich, are rich in essential fatty acids, are rich in multiple micronutrients and as essential fatty acids. But not only that, in many cultures and in many parts of the world, they are foods that people like and want to eat, and they and so it forms a big part of their culture and identity. And if you don't start with that, then no matter how nourishing the food is, it's not going to be part of, in an integral part of the diet. So I really think for the area in which I work, I'm exceedingly happy that the prize came to me. When I look at a large part of my work has been working with young people. I mean, I've been with Worldfish for 10 years, and before that I was at the University of Copenhagen. So I've always worked with young people. And when I moved to Worldfish, I think I brought about 5 interns with me from the university. It's such a pleasure to work with young people. And the way I put it is, imagine being able to work in an area as much as I have for over so many years, and plant an idea in someone's head, a younger person's head, and see that person take that idea to heights that I would never have dreamt of, or come up with new ideas that are totally different from the way I think. So that has been extremely enriching for me and for the work I do. And I do hope that winning this prize will inspire young women and girls to study science, to take up a career in food and nutrition. And if they would look at my career, they would see that it's extremely rewarding, extremely invigorating. You can reach far and you can have a good time.
True inspiration. That's fantastic. I'm going to read a bit more of your background and bio here. So Dr. Thilstead is the global lead for nutrition and public health at Worldfish, as we had mentioned, which is a global CGIAR research center headquartered in Malaysia. She was awarded the 2021 World Food Prize Laureate for her groundbreaking research, critical insights, and landmark innovations in developing holistic nutritional sensitive approaches to aquatic food systems, including fisheries and aquaculture. And for our listening audience, in the food world, that is the Nobel Prize of food. So that is big doings. That's a drop the mic and truly should be honored. And it's our pleasure to have you on to talk about that. She played a key role in the development of Worldfish 2030's research and innovation strategy, which is the Aquatic Foods for Healthy People and Planet. Prior to joining Worldfish in 2010, she worked as an associate professor in the Human Nutrition Departments of the University of Copenhagen and the Royal Veterinary and Agricultural University in Denmark. Shankatala holds a PhD from the Royal Veterinary and Agricultural University in Denmark. Shankatala, I wonder if you could share, as we kind of come to the close of this conversation, share a few things, big or small, that kind of multilaterally contribute to gender equality and to equitable livelihoods?
Well, first of all, that as both Jemima and I are leaders in the UN Food System Summit 2021. And there's a program for champions, for food system champions. So that's one of the first things we can all do. We can all be champions, and we can all work within the systems in our own ways, at country level, within our communities, and at at national and global levels. So I would encourage everyone to find ways to be a food systems champion. And what I have been working with, and which comes out from the kinds of research that I have done, I'd like us to move away from this notion of just feeding people. And I'm still hearing it. It bothers me that, you know, we talk about the world's population is growing. And since the world's population is growing, we need to produce more, and we need to produce more to feed these many mouths. Yes, we do. But it's so much more than that. And we should take into consideration some of the other issues. For example, I'd love the narrative to move from feeding to nourishing, nourishing people, nourishing nations, and nourishing the planet. So it's not only what we produce, but how sustainable we produce it and how we take care of the planet at the same time. And if we would look at nourishing and use that as a framing rather than feeding, perhaps we don't have to think, perhaps we have to think much more, not of quantity, but of quality. The quality of the foods we eat in terms of the nutrient quality and as well as food safety. And importantly, it's not just about producing more. All the evidence shows us that up to one third of what we produce is lost and wasted. So if we would start with trying to reduce the loss and waste rather than producing more, I think we would get much further and it would be much better for mankind and for the planet.
I love it. The value-based food system based on nourishing people and the planet. That is very concise and very accurate. Jemima, let me ask you the same question. What would you share with our listening audience, big or small, that could contribute to gender equality and also to equitable livelihoods?
I think as Shakuntala says, one of the things that we are trying to do is, you know, take some leadership on certain issues within the UN food systems. And what I'm leading is making sure that even as we transform our food systems so that they nourish people, they nourish the planet, that they are also just and equitable, that everybody has access to the right foods that nourish them, the food systems provide decent livelihoods to those who depend on them, smallholder farmers, women, pastoralists, food industry workers, that they can actually have decent livelihoods from food systems. And the other thing that I think we really need to do is making sure that women's voices and leadership is prominent in food systems. Because we say, especially at the farm level, that they are producing a lot of the food we eat, they're providing a lot of the labor on farms, they're providing a lot of the services in terms of moving food as traders. But as you go up into where the decisions about food systems are made, the women become less. So we need women's voices and leadership in food systems, because I think it's the only way that we can actually make sure that food systems are just. So I've been working with all as the custodian for gender equality and women's empowerment, making sure I'm working with all the action track leaders, those who are leading the development of these game-changing solutions that are going to change our food systems, to make sure that gender equality, the empowerment of women is embedded in those solutions, and to make sure that we are thinking about equity, we are thinking about inclusion, we are thinking about people's dignity.
And if I may add one point, Jemima, I think we have to really look hard as to how you and I and all others working in the food systems, how we do this. Because I feel that we are falling short. We are listening to the voices and we are asking about the issues. We are taking the stories and the narratives, and we are relating the issues and how the issues affect women. We are not going to the women and getting the voices on the solutions. And I do think that if we would move that extra step and work together with the woman to identify and to identify the solutions, to develop the solutions, and to ensure that the solutions work for them, we would get much further with having a very successful food systems. But we are stopping short.
I agree with you totally, Shakuntala. And we have actually started a lot of dialogues with women. We've heard a couple of regional dialogues. We've had dialogues with Indigenous women, because I believe very strongly, as you say, that the solutions will come from them. And I have also the strong belief that women actually have voices. We just haven't been hearing them. We have not been taking the time to listen to those voices. And that's really top of my agenda, starting with these regional dialogues and national dialogues that actually just engage women to make sure we're listening to them and to make sure that the solutions are coming from them, and they're not going to be imposed top down, because we have seen from experience that doesn't work. And I always say, you know, women have been in food systems for generations. They've been farmers, they've been traders, they are experimenting. Every day they are experimenting on how to address some of the challenges that they face. And if we can listen to them and make the investments where they matter, we really are going to see changes.
Well, Shakuntala, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share such inspiration. And congratulations again on being awarded the World Food Prize Laureate. That's just amazing. So thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you, Aaron. And thank you, Jemima, for being here with me. It's really good. And let's work together in the food systems. It would be great if we can travel and we can bring some of the women we work with and some of the voices to the summit.
Fantastic. That will be fun. I'm looking forward to it. And it's been such a pleasure to have this conversation with you, Shakuntala, and Aaron. Fantastic co-hosts. So great doing this with you.
Yes, you as well. Anytime, you got an open seat here in the co-host seat. So I look forward to it, Jemima. Thank you very much for taking the time. So I'll just say until next time.